Hello and welcome to this week's edition of The Front Page. We'll be digesting all the big stories from the world of racing over the next 30 minutes or so, beginning with the action from Cheltenham, but also looking at the latest in the John Dance case, the government's belated response to the affordability checks petition, and the entrance of a certain somebody into the jungle. But first of all, let me introduce you to my panel. Joining me in the studio today is Mr. Lee Modishead, fresh from both a weekend at Cheltenham and an unfortunate injury.
Yeah, very unfortunate. I don't want people to feel too sorry for me, but on Thursday, I was taking part in a circuits class. Actually, it was just a one-on-one circuits class because nobody else turned up for it. My teacher, lovely man called Steve, is also a member of the owners group, so he had a good weekend.
Fantastic.
Stage star. But one of Steve's great passions in a circuit class is to lay out a series of mini hurdles, which you're then supposed to sort of jump like that, moving across.
Yeah.
And I did a bit of an Annie Power, and I got the final jump wrong, landed very awkwardly. Thought I'd broken my foot, still managed to get home. And as someone who's had a lot of fractures in the past, two elbows, a foot, nose, little finger, I know what a break feels like. But on this occasion, I was wrong. And viewers will be pleased to know it was only torn ligaments and a sprain.
It didn't stop you from getting to Cheltenham or indeed into the front page studio. So fair play to you. The gym class ended just to zero, which was a bit unfortunate. But you know, thank God he had the celebrations at Cheltenham to make up for that slight disappointment there.
Yeah, and I've got a diary item for later on as well. So we're hey.
Perfect stuff. Yeah. Perfect stuff. And joining us on video link from his East Anglian HQ is Peter Scargill. How are you, Pete?
I'm good, yes, as we were discussing, looking sharp with my new haircut that my daughter did from me a few days ago. So, yeah, I'm pumped and ready to go and fully fighting fit, unlike other members of the team today.
Just for the benefit of the audience, Pete, how old is your daughter?
She's six, and she has amazing clipper skills, as anyone watching the video can see.
Fantastic. Excellent. Okay, well, let's get straight in. We're going to launch immediately into a piece of breaking news because as of Monday morning, it has been announced slightly surprising news that for the first time with Paul Nicholls, Brave Man's Game, his big hope for the Gold Cup, will not be ridden by Harry Cobden in the Betfair Chase on Saturday. He will instead be ridden by former Ditch Heat partner Daryl Jacob. Lee, tell us about this story.
Yes, so Barry Orr, who produces the marketing comms for Betfair, who sponsor Paul Nicholls, put out a press release this morning with quotes from Paul that said that Brave Man's Game is an intended runner in the Betfair Chase on Saturday, depending on how the weather goes during the week. They don't want heavy ground, but the forecast looks pretty dry at the moment for Haydock. And that if he runs on Saturday, Daryl Jacob will ride him, and that Daryl had schooled the horse this morning. He referenced Daryl's great experience. Daryl was also obviously a multiple Betfair Chase winner on Bristol Demai, and it was explained in the press release that Harry Cobden, Paul's stable jockey, is going to be at Ascot instead on Saturday for a number of important rides, one of which will be Peak Doherty in the 1965 Chase. Now, at face value, people will see this and think this is a bit unusual. In that Brave Man's Game is the highest profile horse in the yard. He's the King George VI Chase winner. He's the Cheltenham Gold Cup second. And he'll be marching towards both those races again this season. And people will say it does seem odd that the stable jockey isn't riding the highest profile horse in the yard in the biggest race of the day on Saturday. And they might also reference the fact that on Friday at Cheltenham, Paul wasn't happy with the ride that Harry gave Captain Teague in a Grade 2 novice hurdle. And he spoke about that in my colour piece from Cheltenham on Saturday. But he'd been very happy with a ride on Stage Star at Cheltenham on Saturday in the Paddy Power Gold Cup. And I'm told this morning from within the setup there that there is nothing suspicious about it. It is purely that Harry has a big book of rides, or Paul has a big team of runners at Ascot on Saturday, headed by Peak Doherty, and that Brave Man's Game might not run at Haydock anyway, depending on the weather. And therefore, it's simply they see it as a sensible deployment of resources at Haydock on Haydock and Ascot on Saturday. I suppose what would be interesting is Brave Man's Game goes and wins by 10 lengths and produces a stellar performance. Then there'll be some people inevitably saying, yeah, will Darryl Jacob keep the ride in the King George VI chase? But prior to now, Harry Cobden has been the only jockey ever to ride Brave Man's Game. And I don't think anybody would say that Harry has done a bad job in that at all.
No, 18 runs, 18 times Harry Cobden has taken the ride. It's inevitable people will sort of talk about this and will question whether there is anything else afoot here, especially given Paul Nicholls always very upfront, and as you quoted on Saturday, you know, he wasn't totally happy with Harry's performance on Friday. So it is inevitable that people will therefore take two and two and come up with their own conclusion.
Yeah, they will, clearly. And of course, the irony is that Darryl Jacob used to be the number one for Paul Nicholls, and he too was replaced later on by Sam Twisson Davis, who was replaced by Harry Cobden. And these things happen within yards. But I think when Paul was speaking on Saturday about that Captain Teague ride, again, he was very clear and specific in what he thought was wrong. He explained why tactically he thought they'd got it wrong with Captain Teague. He also referenced the fact when we spoke that Harry had a fall on Thursday, which he thought maybe impacted his riding on Friday, but that he had been delighted with his ride on Stage Star. And Harry Cobden, in general terms, is a jockey whose star has very much been in the ascendancy. He's second in the Jockeys' Championship race. He does still have a chance of being champion jockey. He is, generally speaking, riding incredibly well. So I think if you look at the bigger picture, it would seem odd if Harry Cobden was being jocked off Brave Man's Game on Saturday. And I say, within the camp, they are clear that that isn't the case. It is simply, as they're saying, a sensible way to deploy their jockeys on Saturday.
Let's turn to Cheltenham. You were there reporting for the Racing Post over the weekend. We've already mentioned Stage Star, obviously one of the highlights of the meeting. But what for you was the standout performance that you were taking away from the three-day meeting?
Standout performance, I'd say, was Burdett Road in the Juvenile Hurdle, the Grade 2 Triumph Trial on Saturday. And I'd say, I reference that not only because it was a particularly impressive performance, given a very confident ride by Harry Cobden, who dropped him out of the back, recognised what his mount could do in terms of producing a turn of foot, gave him plenty to do, but the horse did it and won really impressively. But what I think was particularly important about that horse's win on Saturday is that Burdett Road is the textbook example of the sort of horse that British jump racing has been lacking. He's a 103 rated flat horse. He's listed Group 3 class on the flat. He's exactly the type of horse that would once have been switching from a flat racing career to 2 mile hurdling, going Supreme, Triumph, and then Champion Hurdle route. Exactly the sort of horse that we have been missing. And that's why Champion Hurdles and Grade 1 hurdles in Britain in recent years have been particularly weak, because that sort of horse, now generally speaking, is sold to go racing on the flat in Australia or Hong Kong or the Middle East. To their credit, the Gredley family turned down offers for Burdett Road. Now, they're a wealthy family, so they're not in need of the cash, but they could have cashed in on Burdett Road. Tim Gredley, Bill Gredley's son, made the point on Saturday that the sensible thing would have been to sell, but they're in it to enjoy watching their horses race. And they were mindful of the fact that Burdett Road is exactly the sort of horse that we've been missing. Thankfully, we've got him. So I thought that was my single performance of the week. I thought Stage Star was super in the Paddy Power Gold Cup, given again a great ride by Harry Cobden. We had that drama at the final fence. And I thought, really interesting, yesterday on Sunday, we speak about the Nicholls-Cobden combo earlier on. It was a big Sunday for Nico de Boinville and Nicky Henderson. Both their big winners, John Bond and Iberico Lord, are owned by JP McManus. It's well documented that JP decides who rides his horses. On many occasions within Seven Barrows, that is Nico de Boinville, but on some high-profile horses, including John Bond, it hasn't been. in separate interviews I did last jump season with Nico and with Nick Henderson, they both spoke about the fact that, of course, they would like Nico to be riding more of the horses, but they spoke very diplomatically. Nico has handled that situation with real dignity, and I think it was an important day for him on Sunday at Cheltenham. Nicky made that point as well, that it was important for Nico to have won both those races. And whilst nobody would be happy that Aidan Coleman wasn't able to ride, because like Nico, he's one of the weighing room's good guys, that there'd have been a lot of delight that Nico had a chance to shine on those two horses and did a really good job. So lots of interesting things at Cheltenham.
What did we learn from John Bond's victory as well?
I think we learned that El Fabiolo does have a serious challenger in the Champion Chase. You look at the Champion Chase market, it's pretty depressing. You've got two horses under 20-1 in the betting, one at even money, one at 5-2, 20-1 bar that. It looks like a two-horse race. And if you looked at last year's Arkle, or last season's Arkle, you'd be saying it's a one-horse race because El Fabiolo beat John Bond convincingly. But I think Nicky Henderson is adamant that we didn't see the real John Bond in the Arkle last season. And when it was put to him on Sunday, can you see this horse reversing the form with El Fabiolo next March? He said, yes, he can. And I think based on what we saw on Sunday, if you're a supporter of John Bond for the Champion Chase in March, you will have gone away encouraged by what you witnessed, particularly as that was his first run of the season.
Pete, it wasn't just Cheltenham in action at the weekend. We also had Navan's new festival. Probably the standout star there was Facile Vega. What did you make of Facile Vega's victory?
Well, I would be no expert when it comes to assessing a horse's jumping and how they do things over fences, but he seemed quite proficient. There was a couple of novice mistakes that I suppose you would expect from a novice. But in general, look, he's a horse. He was extremely good in bumpers. He's extremely good over hurdles, and he's going to be extremely good over fences, isn't he? And no doubt he'll be plotted towards the Cheltenham Festival very efficiently by Willie Mullins. The horse is second in the pocket quality wise as well, I think, in terms of the future. So, like encouraging there from both of those horses, and hopefully some extra depth to the novice chase department when we come around to the spring races, rather than scaring people off. So, you know, he was certainly good. It was good to see Bob Ollinger win. Probably not quite as impressively as it looked when he loomed up on the bridle, but given how good he was going to be and how good he proved not to be last season, if that makes sense, it was nice to see him get his head back in front. Gordon Elliott just about scraped in the Troy Town with his 15 runners.
14 runners in the end, Pete, in fairness, we should say.
Good point, Tom. I held my hands up. Accuracy is very important. Obviously, Gavin Cromwell, who's you know, his record at Cheltenham, to go back to Cheltenham, he's 5 winners from 12 runners this year. He's a guy who's proven very effective at targeting races, big races, nearly upset the Elliott party there. So, look, that was good. And I've got one other. Oh, yes, Captain Guinness in the Fortria. He was good as well. But obviously, that really only served to boost John Bond, really, didn't it? Given John Bond beat him out of sight when they last met. So, yeah, look, it seemed to work well. The Navan weekend, obviously, I wasn't there. But it seemed to work well as a double header rather than as a single meeting. And some interesting and eye-catching performances, you'd have thought.
Also not at Navan was Navan's finest, David Jennings, because instead he was at Cheltenham. And Lee, he wrote a very interesting piece speaking to some of his compatriots. It's in today's paper and online for members now, basically talking about how the November meeting has become the new festival for plenty of Cheltenham aficionados. It's slightly quieter, the town, you know, it's easier to get around the place, the race course in the town, get tables, restaurants, whatever. The atmosphere is still great, the racing's still great, and Cheltenham are leaning into this big time. They get about 60,000 over the 3 days. They're aiming to make that 70,000 within the next couple of years. You know, what's your assessment of it? Do you think the November meeting is just going to go from strength to strength, and is it better than the festival?
No, it's not. It's very good. What's not to enjoy? 3 days at Cheltenham, quality racing, but for me, the festival towers above everything else. That's not to say I didn't really enjoy the November meeting, the open that was. I can absolutely understand why those Irish racegoers that DJ spoke to said they prefer November. I know a lot of other people do as well, because for the points that you laid out, as a customer experience, it's bound to be more enjoyable if you can just get around.
More affordable as well.
Absolutely, more affordable, yeah. More enjoyable. One thing I would say about the November meeting, and I was looking to try and get it into one of the two colour pieces I wrote of the weekend, but events overtake you and you only have a certain amount of space. And I already annoy subs enough by trying to overwrite and get more than I should do. But there were two consecutive handicaps on Saturday. 3 mile handicap hurdle and a 2 mile 5 furlong intermediate handicap hurdle, whose prize money was less than it was 20 years ago. Now, we generally associate this sort of thing with racecourses that aren't Cheltenham, but those two races are contests I've picked up on in the past in copy and noted that their prize money is way below what it used to be. The 3 mile handicap hurdle in particular was worth £30,000 on Saturday. It was worth £40,000 in 2003. It was worth £55,000 in 2004. It's now worth £30,000. Now, you could argue that one reason for that is that at Haydock on Saturday, also a Jockey Club track, you've got a £125,000 3 mile handicap hurdle. One's a class one, one's a class two, but they're basically the same race, that open 3 mile handicap hurdles. So perhaps one race doesn't really fit in the programme. Perhaps things need to be tickled and amended. But I did think it was odd, and I do think it's odd, that you have two races like that that maybe aren't getting the fields as strong as they could be. Certainly intermediate hurdle is a lot weaker than it was in the past. And they are worth considerably less than was once the case. And I think we pick up on that for racecourses outside of the elite tracks. I think it's only fair that when we see it with an elite track, we do pick up on
it. It's also the case, actually, at some of the festival contests.
Oh,
where some of the prize money pots are very low, considering the prestige and the crowds and everything and the betting activity. But I think that's a topic for another day, because we go down the prize money route at our peril if we want to get through the rest of the show. We're just going to take a very quick break for an advert for our latest Members Club Ultimate offer. Welcome back. We're going to dive straight into our next story now. Pete, I'm going to come to you because you've been following the John Dance case very closely over the last few months. Tell us what's the latest and give a very brief recap of the story to date.
Sure. So a couple of developments last week in terms of the ongoing cataloguing of the dance situation. I'm going to call it the dance situation for now. So first of all, there was the intermediate report, a 6 month report from the special administrators who've been looking at Welsh Tech LLP, which was Dance's company that went into, it was shut down in April after the discovery of serious regulatory and operational issues by the Financial Conduct Authority, which is the city regulator. So there was a 6 month review that was investigation that was published. Some interesting insights into that, particularly the suggestion that the administrators were having some real difficulty untangling what was been going on there. The records were very difficult to follow. They'd had to do a lot of analysis of financial transactions to try and understand how there'd been an 80 million back hole develop, 80 million down from 81 million, so they found £1 million, so that's a start, isn't it? They talked about there being the company's been run with a gap in their finances for a prolonged period of time. So this isn't something that's just developed; it's something that's clearly built and built and built. So that was one aspect, giving us some insight into what was going on.
Pete, just very quickly to jump in there. Just for the reader's benefit, how is this likely to unfold? Is this a case that is going to end up in the High Court?
it looks that way unless some sort of deal is struck. So the fact that the Financial Conduct Authority amended the freezing order they had in place. So they had a freezing order that went in place in April, immediately after WealthTech LLP was shut down. And this is what caused all the issues with Brave Man's Game running at Aintree and not running at Aintree, and Brian Drew having to buy John Dance out. You'll all remember the drama that happened with that around the bowl chase and then the Punchestown Gold Cup. So they changed that from a £40 million worldwide freezing order, which was a civil piece of piece of documentation, to a restraint order. And a restraint order is something, it can only be, it basically protects assets for future confiscation after a criminal trial, after a criminal finding against someone. So the FCA are they've kept their cards quite close to their chest. There hasn't been a lot of detail coming out of this investigation, but there's little tweaks and little tightenings of what's going on, which give you a good indication of the direction of travel on this one, I have to say.
And there's obviously been a huge number of people who have been caught up in this, both investors in some of Dance's companies, but also the people who have been involved with his racing activities. One of them is of course James Horton, who was his private trainer. He has moved on effectively. Tell us what's happened. What's James' latest movement?
Yeah, so David Milnes, our Newmarket correspondent, spoke with James this week, or last week, I should say. I need to get my dates right. James Horton is going to move into Park Lodge Stables in central Newmarket. It's the old yard of Harry Eustace. Harry Eustace, very upwardly mobile trainer, is moving to other premises. I understand he's moving to premises on Bury Road, although that's not confirmed yet. A bigger place for his more horses. So everything is sort of disintegrating and melting away around Dance's racing empire. Obviously, his horses can't run at the moment. But obviously, there's a lot of things that are unclear and still need to be sorted out, hopefully in time for the next flat season, I suppose, because that's where the majority of Dance's horses are focused. So it could do with not dragging on. Obviously, it's quite a complex financial investigation. It's all a bit of a mess, really, Tom.
It certainly is, but we'll be continuing to follow that story closely, and you'll get all the latest developments in the Racing Post and online. Another story we, of course, have been following extremely closely is the saga around affordability checks and the government policy, which seems to be slowly sort of evolving over time, has taken another slight and interesting turn following their response to the petition against the checks. This petition, launched by Jockey Club Chief Executive Nevin Truesdale, is now up to almost 90,000 signatures. When it gets to 100,000, it will be considered for a debate in Westminster. But in the meantime, the government have given their response to the petition, and it's quite a lengthy and detailed response. We analysed it in detail, and that's available again on the Racing Post website, and we'll put a link to it in the description. But we thought we would touch on the key points of the analysis on the show today. I mean, first of all, it's worth stressing that the government policy is effectively unchanged. They say that they remain committed to implementing what they call a frictionless system of affordability checks in order to prevent people incurring what they call unaffordable losses on their gambling. However, there is an interesting development, because for the first time we can see the debate sort of coalescing into two distinct areas. On the one hand, we have the government's proposals for checks. These have been scrutinised at length and spoken about at length, that whether they're going to be truly frictionless, how much damage they will cause to racing, and how much inconvenience they will cause to bettors have all been major points of conversation. But now, interestingly, we begin to see a focus on what happens before those checks are introduced, what happens in the interim. And for a long time, we and others in racing and betting communities have been trying to make this point exactly clear, which is that while the government policy is important, in the meantime, we already have affordability checks being extremely widely applied perhaps as many as one in five regular racing punters already having been affected by them. And action is being sought on that point as well, because at the current time, people are not only being confronted by these very invasive requests for their financial documents, but the sport is also seeing a decline in its revenues from betting. Lee, I guess the thing to say here would be that they haven't actually taken any action about the interim checks, but they have, for the first time, acknowledged them and made clear that they want to see an improvement in that situation. They want to see more transparency and more consistency. I suppose it's sort of a very small positive step in the right direction.
Yeah, and given there have been so few steps in the right direction, you have to welcome it. The Gambling Commission has never really acknowledged that bookmakers are imposing affordability checks because the Gambling Commission insists they should do. There's never been a specific directive on this one from the Gambling Commission. There had in the past been clear statements about what its view were on affordability checks, and at one point he wanted almost everybody to get caught up in this seemingly. But at least by this response, the government has acknowledged that this is a problem in the here and now. It's spoken about conversations with the Gambling Commission and the Betting and Gaming Council with a view to try and producing at least a more uniform approach to how affordability checks are being implemented at the moment. But it's still, the whole thing still just becomes ever more frustrating. You know, you have a system where the government is talking about not wanting to implement formalised affordability checks until it knows there is a frictionless system for doing that, and that system has been trialled. And at the same time, it's saying we want the current model of affordability checks to be uniform. Mm. If anyone watched this from a different planet would look at what is being said and say none of this makes sense. This can't really be happening.
Yeah,
but it really is.
And the I guess the frustrating thing here is it is not that complex for them to impose transparency and consistency on the existing system. All it requires is a sort of a clear and unequivocal statement from the government about what is expected from bookmakers in the interim. So if they said, for example, you know, this is the figure below which we do not believe bettors should ever be asked for personal financial documentation, then that would be the point at which bookmakers would know they could draw the line.
Yeah.
But in the absence of that, basically there is no solution. And I think this sort of talks to the government's desire to have an answer that pleases everyone. They want to simultaneously get racing and the racing media off its back. They want to avoid offending punters. They want to avoid causing damage to horse racing. They also simultaneously are terrified that the anti-gambling lobby and its outriders in the media are going to pounce on them if they do anything concrete, which seems like a step away from the quite intrusive regime that they have outlined in the white paper, which leaves them in this impossible situation. They seemingly want someone else on a sort of a nod and a wink to agree to do something that will get them out of it. But it is just not going to work, is it?
It's not going to work. And I think it highlights the extent to which the Gambling Commission, the industry regulator, has become almost a liability for the government, in the sense that the government's position is clear on one front, in the sense that this shouldn't be happening. We don't want formalised affordability checks until the system is in place that we know they can work properly.
Yeah.
And yet you have the government's gambling industry regulator has already created a situation whereby these checks are happening at all sorts of different levels across the betting market, causing all sorts of frustration to punters and all sorts of damage to the British racing industry. And I sense from the language that we are hearing at the moment that the government is perhaps starting just to become a little bit frustrated with the position its industry regulator has put itself in. You know, I don't imagine, as you say, the government doesn't want to be in this situation. It knows it's got a hot potato, a really difficult hot potato to handle, but that hot potato has been made ever hotter because of the Gambling Commission.
One other point I thought was worth picking up on in the response, we published a series of articles called the Affordability Files in the last couple of months. You worked on them with our industry editor, Bill Barber. One of those articles looked at the estimate DCMS put on the damage to racing as a result of its checks. It said it would be a maximum of 14.9 million. We did a very forensic piece looking at this and came to the very clear conclusion that that 14.9 million figure was a mistake. It was based on some flawed understandings of British Racing's revenue models and some pretty simplistic extrapolation and mathematics in order to arrive at that figure. The government have said they are working with Racing to refine that estimate. It is essentially an admission that they got it wrong and that the entire premise on which these checks are based is flawed.
Yeah, we knew that already. You know, that's the frustrating thing, that so much of this has been blindingly obvious. Mm. You know, none of this is a surprise, that so much of the foundations on which this white paper has been built were always going to crumble. It was clear that this was built on assumptions and guesswork and estimates
and wishful thinking, frictionless checks, thinking. For example.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, the very fact that this policy is built around being able to carry out frictionless checks, when the originator of the policy knows at the moment you can't do those frictionless checks. I mean, it's utterly ridiculous.
It is extraordinary. The petition, like I say, is at almost 90,000 signatures. If and when it gets to 100,000, which I'm sure it will do, it will be considered for debate in Westminster. And hopefully, if that happens, there will be some enhanced scrutiny of some of these measures. However, from the ridiculous to the ridiculous, we are going to conclude with the entry of a certain Frankie Dettori into the I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here jungle. He's not there yet, but apparently we will be there. Apparently he's going to be arriving late. He's as big as nines to win it, the same price as Nigel Farage, read into that what you will. Someone called Danielle Harold is the favourite, and another person called Sam Thompson is the Racing Post tip. Put up at sixes, now no bigger than 9-2. Still value? I don't know who he is. What do we think? How's Frankie going to get on in the jungle?
Don't care remotely.
Oh, come on.
No.
I thought you were a fan of reality TV.
No. I'm a Strictly fan, Tom.
And
I
would a more refined form.
I would much prefer if Frankie had opted to go down a reality TV journey that afforded him more dignity and enabled him to learn the cha-cha-cha. That hasn't happened. No. I've got to be honest, I'm not a viewer, of I'm a Celebrity, although I know that millions of people are. I'm sure it will be very effective at boosting his profile. I do think it's a bit odd if he goes in on the basis that we now know he is planning to have a full-time career as an American-based jockey. I think this made more sense if he just retired, but hey-ho. I don't know. I mean, he's done this before. I remember I interviewed him before Royal Ascot, and the jungle thing was being talked about then, and I mentioned it to him, and his response was along the lines of, yeah, I've done all that stuff before. I'm grand. I can do it. You know, and he's done it when he was in Big Brother. He did an impression of Mussolini, did a drag act. He knows how to play the game. He's a performer, and okay. He will perform, I'm sure.
He did an impression of Mussolini.
Yeah, I think he dressed up as Mussolini and did a drag act, I think. Yeah,
different times.
Not at the same time.
No, different time. Okay,
a drag Mussolini would be an interesting.
Yeah.
And I'm sure he'll do very well. But my problem is, and this sounds terribly pompous, but I don't know who the majority of the people in there are, and therefore trying to compare Frankie relative to them is difficult at this stage. And I just hope when the call comes in for live reporting on this mission, it goes to somebody else.
Well, we'll see. Pete, how about you? You must be a I'm a Celebrity fan.
You can see it's written all over my face how much I'm looking forward to it.
If you could pick from the entirety of racing, who do you think would get on best in the jungle? And perhaps more interestingly, who would get on worst?
Who would get on best and who would get on worst? Now, there's an enjoyable topic. I mean, part of it is given the things that people have to do, you're tempted to put people in the jungle who maybe haven't been so nice to you over the years to see them, you know, dealing with Bush Tucker Charles. I mean, I see that Nigel Farage was wading through waist-deep brown sludge on the first day, a metaphor perhaps for his career. And, you know, he's immediately been voted into the Bush Tucker trial. So, you know, someone, I mean, you know, over the years, I've upset enough people who perhaps would like to see me in the jungle. And given that racing's, you know, got Frankie in there and we had Matt Hancock last year, you know, perhaps racing is developing its own little niche in I'm a Celebrity. And anyway, Lee, you're talking about the cha-cha-cha with Frankie. Yeah. Could Frankie and Farage not cha-cha-cha together? I mean, that's got to be social media gold, if nothing else, across the camp.
Yeah,
come on, we're going to think creatively here.
With one dressed as Mussolini and the other doing a drag act, that would work.
That would work.
If we're being slightly serious on this one, I suppose what we should say is there are so few people within racing's parish that would actually even be considered for a programme like this. You know,
maybe just Frankie. Although, actually, looking at the others, the threshold is not that high.
No, but having said that, we are maybe not reflective of
the target audience.
Yeah,
no.
And I would freely admit that I'm not necessarily completely au fait with what young people are watching and enjoying, and therefore I am probably the sort of old fogey who is never going to really know who 80% of the people on the programme are. But there are very few people in our parish who would even be considered for this sort of thing. Once upon a time, there had gone to people like John McCrerick, sort of Claire Balding has that sort of status, but there aren't many who you'd think.
Our producer's just told us Willie Carson did it as well.
Yes, producer Sam has just reported, to my great shock,
I've never been a big jungle aficionado. I have to be honest.
Well, that was nice though for Willie. I'm sure he enjoyed it.
He did well, apparently.
Yeah. And you get to go to a nice Australia's lovely, isn't it?
Yeah. And on that bombshell, the world's finest I'm a Celebrity betting preview brought to you by the Racing Post. We do actually have a better one online, which I do recommend in the sports section. Lee, we need to decide what goes on the front page. You're normally in this seat.
Yeah.
How did you find the flip?
Well, on the basis that when I'm in your seat, and as someone who lives with a very difficult guilt complex, I find it very hard to give myself the prize. Mm. On that basis, if I were you, I'd be looking at someone with a heavily bruised foot who very rarely gives himself the prize, and I'd be saying, might be quite nice if you gave him the prize.
It's good. It's good. Excellent guilt complex.
Thank you. Nice.
I'm immune to guilt though, so I'm gonna put the petition response on the front page. The petition closing in on 100,000 signatures. The biggest story in racing right now. Hopefully, it will not be forever. But that is it for this week. Thank you very much, Lee, for joining me. It's a pleasure to have you in the studio. And thank you very much, Pete, as well. And thank you at home for joining us for this week's edition of The Front Page. We'll be back next week with all the biggest stories in the sport, much more debate, And before we go, do take a look at our latest enhancements to the Racing Post app and give it a download. Thanks again for joining us.
You spoke, we listened. Introducing Race Cards Redefined. 3 brand new and unique race cards tailored for your needs. Our new and improved standard race card is the punter's favourite and is everything you need to make your selection. Get the maximum amount of information in the palm of your hand with Expert View. Cover all areas and get all the same information as our newspaper. With Compact View, you can make a quick decision on who to back. View more runners and more odds on one race. Which race card will you choose?